Today we welcome Joseph Atwill to Skeptico. And why don't you tell us what the central thesis of Caesar's Messiah is?
Well, it is that the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were created as a typological prefiguration of a Roman Caesar's military campaign. The concept of typologic prefiguration is one that a lot of your listeners may be unfamiliar with, but just in general, it's using prior stories to create a relationship between two individuals. So that the best example of this, in fact, is the character Jesus Christ himself, where the authors have used all of these characters from the Old Testament to show that the character Jesus Christ was prefigured by the Hebraic scripture.
Give folks a quick example of some of those parallels, because they are rather striking and they'll be immediately recognizable to people.
Well, the one that I actually spend most time with in the book, and I do so because it's the very system that links forward to the Roman Caesars, is the one that begins in the very first page of the New Testament in Matthew. And the storyline is easy to follow. Everyone, I imagine, has some familiarity with it. It just, in Matthew, you have Joseph goes to Egypt. Joseph is a dreamer of dreams and decides he wants to travel to Egypt. He's the patriarch, you know, the father of the character Jesus Christ. And from there, the story goes that Herod massacres the boys. Matthew 2:20, you decide to return. There's a statement that they are dead which sought the young child's life. And then you go from Egypt back to Israel. At that point, you have a baptism. Jesus passes through water and is baptized. And then he goes into the wilderness. He goes in for 40 days. And you have these three episodes where the statements, he's tempted by bread, and he's told, you know, the devil's told not to tempt God, and is finally is commanded to worship only God. Well, so these eight events are not history. They are typologic prefiguration, because these are the stories that came from the Old Testament. In Genesis 45, Joseph goes to Egypt. It is not Herod, but of course, Pharaoh massacres the boys. It's a verbatim quote in Exodus 4, all the men are dead which sought thy life. You have the return from Egypt to Israel. You have the baptism, the Israelites pass through the water. And of course, Jesus has been typologically linked to the nation of Israel by the statement that I called him out of Egypt, the description of Jesus, which designates him as the nation of Israel symbolically. And then it's the wilderness for 40 years. Notice Jesus is 40 days. I mean, this is typology. It's not verbatimism. There is just enough information, you know, that is passing back and forth between the stories so that an alert reader would recognize that one is dependent on the other. But there you have the three experiences of Jesus. And in fact, it's actually verbatim quotes, tempted by bread, do not tempt God, and worship only God. So in that prefiguration, what they're doing is they're showing that the Old Testament character Moses prefigured. His life really was deliberately and divinely wired into this character Jesus Christ, that Jesus is essentially repeating this pattern of events that that Moses went through, not in a verbatim way. They're not exactly the same, but there's obviously enough similarities so that an alert reader can see that Moses prefigured Jesus.
Or even a reader who wasn't alert could kind of subliminally, subconsciously gain an affinity towards this new character because he's following a path that you've already...
Exactly. Well said, actually. That's sort of what they're trying to do. They just want you to take the character Jesus Christ basically in the same context as you would hold the character Moses. See, so that's all that typologic prefiguration does this. And now the character Jesus Christ has this odd prophecy about the coming of a son of, somebody calls the Son of Man, which is a messianic title. And he states he's going to come during the Roman War. He says, when this guy comes, you're going to have Jerusalem encircled. The temple complex will be razed. The abomination of desolation will occur. And it's this event, these events will occur before the generation that Jesus is talking to passes away. Now, this is 40 years. That's the length of time of a generation in Hebraic literature. And so basically he's saying that before Passover 73, the Son of Man will come and he'll do these things. And these are all events from the Roman-Jewish war. And in 40 years, in fact, someone comes and does all these things. That's the individual Titus Flavius. He's a historical character. And he is the Roman commander during the siege of Jerusalem. He encircles it with a wall. He raises the temple complex. And he brings about the abomination of desolation. The war that he wages concludes exactly 40 years to the day from the conclusion of Jesus's ministry. The fall of Masada occurs on Passover 73. So you have this 40-year cycle being fulfilled. And so you know that when Jesus is predicting the Son of Man, that he's talking about this Roman Caesar. There's no one else who could be the individual from the context of history.
Now, hold on, Jill. Let me interject here because I want to slow that down a little bit so that people can catch it, because it's quite a profound set of parallels that you're drawing there in terms of its implications. So what you're saying is that if one traces the history that we know of that period, we see the same parallels in the historical accounts to the biblical accounts, and they only can lead us to one conclusion, and that is that the Bible was written in a way to point towards Titus as being the Messiah, which is quite controversial, quite revolutionary, and the way you get there, again, is through this drawing on the parallels between what we know of the historical accounts and what we know of the biblical accounts. Again, summarize for people how that theory really stands in terms of biblical scholarship as we know it, because it's quite a departure. It's not a complete departure. There's some other folks that have kind of gone down this similar path, but you've really taken it to another level, right?
Right. Well, no one actually ever asked the very simple question of, did the character Jesus Christ, who's obviously a typological, prefigured individual, did the authors who created this character using their typologic prefiguration, did they then use the character to typologically prefigure the Son of Man that he predicted? Now, this may seem like this is sort of a complicated thing to ask, but in fact, from the perspective of literary criticism, it's the very first question that should be asked is, did the authors simply stay in the same genre? We know they're writing typologic prefiguration when they create Jesus Christ. So did they use him as typologic prefiguration for this character they also created out in the future?
And the motivation for that obviously would be to get people to believe that the new king is the religious king, as we've seen in political and the relationship between politics and religion throughout history. We've seen this use of politics and religion to influence, coerce, and subjugate people. So that would have been the obvious motive for writing into the Gospels the idea that Titus, the Roman Empire, was really the Messiah that everyone should worship.
Right. I mean, they had a political motivation that includes that and other components. But the I think the primary motivation was just vanity. The Roman Caesars, this was the era of the imperial cult. And the Caesar claimed to be a living god. There were temples built to worship him as a god. The Caesars attempted to place statues of themselves as gods in the Jews' temple in Jerusalem. The Jews, because of their dictum concerning graven images, couldn't abide with this, and they rebelled. This was the cause of the war. Then at the conclusion of the war, Titus attempted to force the Jews to call him Lord by burning them. And even then, they refused to call him God or Lord. And so being very stubborn, the Caesars then decided that they would create their Gospels with this character, the Son of Man, who is not identified. Jesus doesn't say, you know, when Titus Flavius comes, all these things will happen, because then they knew that no one would worship the character. So they just left him only identifiable through the typology. It was the Gospels, even though they look like religious literature and they function as it, are actually just a vanity piece. I would suggest your listeners look at photographs on the internet of the Arch of Titus in Rome, and there you'll see Vespasian and Titus, two of the Flavian Caesars, identified as God the Father and the Son of God, and the events of the Jewish war that Jesus predicts, right, that will occur when the Son of Man comes, are just being represented. So really, the Gospels are just a literary version of the Arch of Titus.
So let me, if you will, jump ahead a little bit in the story, because you've introduced this other element of it, is the vanity element of it, which I guess I hadn't fully absorbed as being one of the primary drivers. But I can definitely see that. I mean, that makes total sense, too, from a political power standpoint. It's always about vanity, right? I mean, that's what power is ultimately about. What I liked about what you did in the book and in the movie was, you know, if we fast forward to the 4th century, and we look at Constantine and the relationship that he has with Christianity and his founding of the Christian church, this relationship between the existing political power structure and the religious beliefs of the population they're trying to control becomes even more clear. So do you want to talk a little bit and share a little bit with people? Tell us about Constantine and serfdom, maybe, and the parallels between the church that Constantine sets up and what was already in place.
Right. Well, Constantine begins the process in around 304 of making Roman Catholicism the state religion, and it's a brutal process. They're destroying other temples. They're killing people who won't convert. So it's this long process that takes around 70 years, and quite a few Caesars are engaged in it. Constantine gets this very positive legacy for some reason for having brought this religion into European culture as the Roman state religion, because purportedly it takes us out of what's called paganism, whatever anyone means by that. But the fact is that Constantine also issued the edicts which began the feudal system. Now, the feudal system is a slave system. The word serf is just a synonym for slave. And if you look at the hierarchy structure of it, which are often documented in paintings from the era, you have the Pope at the top, and then you have the emperor, and then you have the cardinals, and the religious and military individuals are sort of interspersed as you go down. At the very bottom, you have the serf, who is literally an animal. So again, it's just perplexing to me why historians choose to isolate the edict that creates Christianity from the edicts that create the feudal system. They obviously are part of the same process.
Because the feudal system that he implements replaces a system that is more democratic, more libertarian than the feudal system that he sets up, by far, right?
Absolutely. There were a whole class of citizens called the coloni who developed ownership rights by essentially cultivating wild land. They would colonize it. That's actually the basis of the expression colonization. And they would turn wild land into farming land, and then they could own the product of the land. Constantine reversed this, and he began these series of edicts which stated that you couldn't own land. You couldn't own the product of the land. Your children could be sold. You see, if the magistrate decided they needed population in some other area, you couldn't change vocations. You had to have the same vocation as your father, and you were bound to the land. You couldn't ever leave it. So this was the beginning of the feudal system. And if you look at the Roman Catholic Church as it is a component of the feudal system, it's very obvious how it functioned. It was the mind control device whereby the serf was given a religious context for slavery. In other words, he was told that the representative of Jesus Christ basically is telling him, to accept his plight. There's going to be a kind of worker's paradise for the individual once he dies. But in the meantime, do what the magistrates tell you to do, and everything will be fine. So all Christianity was to Constantine was simply a way to create the mind control of the slaves that would think that they were doing the work of their God, as opposed to following the commands of Caesar. So this was just a way of getting rid of rebellion. And Constantine was well aware of the origins of the Christian religion. He knew that, well, first of all, his actual name was Flavius Constantine, so I suspect he was actually a family member of the Caesars who established the religion. And if you look at his burial site, you'll see that what he did was he brought the remains, purportedly, of the 12 disciples, and he encircled his grave with theirs, with these artifacts. So he's clearly making the representation that he is Jesus Christ, just are the Son of Man, just as Titus and Vespasian claim to be God the Father and the Son of God that is prefigured in the Gospels.
And the same as almost every emperor and ruler throughout time has claimed to be the God of the people who...
Right. And so you see, it's just, it's actually, even though I'm, you know, people are attacking me with these wild, this idea that this is some kind of wild theory. Actually, I hate to tell them, it's just completely routine. This pattern just plays itself out over and over and over again. No one should be surprised that at the root of Christianity is a leader trying to create some kind of mind control for his subjects.
Okay, I think this is a lot of compelling evidence that you lay out with Constantine. This is 302 AD. Anyone who believes that action speaks louder than words, I think, will have trouble coming to a different conclusion when you look at what was done. How far back can we push this, though, Joe? And I think this is where the controversy really kind of rises up. Can we push this back to 2nd century AD, 1st century AD, as you do, and go all the way and say, from the beginning, this was a mind control vanity play to create this religion?
Right. Well, the motivations of Caesar's, I think it's very hard for people who are not psychopaths to have any, you know, direct connection to. I mean, these are individuals that could execute and did, you know, thousands of people on a whim. They portrayed themselves as gods. Nero used to enjoy having captives covered with tar and then lit a fire as he would come into a room. This would sort of illuminate his spiritual presence. The Caesars used to enjoy a kind of dinner theater where they would reenact the capturing of some highwayman or a bandit and then actually crucify him on their stage. I mean, literally crucify him and have him die. So, you know, this mindset is really not with us, at least among, you know, common people at this point. And so to try to speculate, you know, about, well, what exactly are they doing with the religion as they develop it? I certainly think that just the description of it being a vanity piece is an accurate one. But to actually, you know, try to delineate, you know, how this affected them and what they were trying to achieve, I fortunately am not, I don't have that kind, that deep of a neurosis. So I just would have to guess at it. The religion also had a political purpose, too. They wanted to try to slow down the missionary activity. They had a court historian who actually wrote the history that has the episodes that, you know, the Gospels are describing in their prefiguration. This court historian was named Flavius Josephus. He said that the...
Can I interrupt you for a second? Go back and tell people who Josephus is, because it's a fascinating story that I just wasn't aware of, and I think other people find it interesting as well.
Well, Josephus is the only historian that wrote an existing history of first century Judea, who was actually on the ground. He was born in, I think it was 37, 44, I forget which year, but he was alive in the first century. He claimed to have been a member of all three of the Jewish sects, the Essenes, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees. He claimed to be a child prodigy, was dazzling people when he was like 13 years old with his intellectual capacities, just like Jesus did. He was a friend of Nero's wife somehow. Then when the rebellion broke out in 66, he became the leader of the Galilean forces, a general. He claimed to have been a priest and a member of the Hasmonean family. So somehow he became a leader of the rebellion. The Flavians captured him. Now, here the story just gets completely weird because he claimed that God communicated with him at that point and told him that the covenant that had existed with the Jews and God was broken.
Well, a lot of people still claim that today when they get arrested by the police and they flip on their buddies. And they have all sorts of explanations for why they flip, but that's what happened.
Right.
I mean, he was on the other side. They captured him and they flipped him, right?
They flipped him and he said, look, that the old covenant is dead. There's a new covenant. And this, of course, is the theological foundation of what becomes the New Testament, which is just an expression meaning new covenant, because the Son of Man is obvious in the new covenant is looking forward to the divine Caesars. And so Flavius Josephus goes, okay, the prophecies we had, which we thought foresaw a Jew as the Messiah, were all wrong. They foresee the Roman Caesar. This is really who the prophecies foresee. And from this point forward, the Flavians, who are the generals of the war, Vespasian and his son Titus, they adopt Josephus first simply as a confidant and someone who was helping them with the wage war against the Jews. But after the war, they actually literally adopt him, and he takes the name Flavius Josephus. He's given a townhouse in the imperial court, and he then is told to write the official history of the war for the Flavians. So he records their military triumphs. He is completely integral to the history of Christianity. Virtually all of our capacity to date events and any sort of understanding of characters like John the Baptist from the perspective of a historian all come through Josephus.
And let me just interject. Sure. I mean, what's most important to your book, Caesar's Messiah, and your general thesis is that Josephus's book, his historical account titled The War of the Jews, is stunning to the extent that it parallels so many of the parts that we've come to know as the Gospels. So anyone who just lays these down side by side, it's almost impossible to suggest otherwise that there aren't these parallels, right?
Right, and of course, many, many scholars have seen parallels. What has been missed to date is just that they occur in the same sequence and the number of them. It's odd in New Testament scholarship, one person will write about the fact that there's a story about binding and loosening in the Gospels, and then there's also a story about binding and loosening in Josephus's history. They'll notice that Jesus predicts Jerusalem will be encircled with a wall, and they notice that Josephus records it. They see the abomination of desolation, and then in the Gospels, and then Josephus quoted it.
And in the Gospels, let's be clear, in the Gospels, these are prophecies, right?
Yeah.
These are great visions that what may come in the future. And what Josephus is writing is he's saying, oh, these aren't prophecies. These are history. I was there on the ground. This is what happened.
Exactly.
So the obvious conclusion
well, it was
that we draw
is... Well, it was so widely understood at one point in Christian theology that Josephus's work was attached to the Gospels because the position of the what's called the preterites, who were the dominant Christian theologians for the first 1900 years, was that the prophecies that Jesus made can be shown as divine because, look, the historian recorded all of them.
Right. Right.
See, so
right,
this
right.
this relationship, the one that I'm showing, this revolutionary idea was actually the dominant Christian theology for 1900 years. They took the position, though, that what they were looking at was proof of divinity.
Exactly.
You see, not
that.
Something.
So that's how they were selling it. They were selling it as
proof of divinity, as opposed to just saying, "Well, no, in fact, it just means that the Gospels are fiction, and they used this history to set up the story of this character, Jesus Christ."
Okay, I think that does an awesome job of really kind of encapsulating the most important points that you're trying to advance. It's quite, as people will say, it's quite a stunning theory. And it really sucks you in. It certainly sucked me in. It's just captivating. And you're to be congratulated for having such an innovative view on a topic that's been combed over, to say the least, for hundreds and hundreds of years. But we have to turn and look at the critics, the Joseph Atwell Christian Messiah critics. And when I did, the first person I came across was a gentleman named Chris White. He has a little website called Caesar's Messiah Debunked. And he's also been a former guest on this show. We talked to him about a totally unrelated topic. And we also had on his friend, and I think a source for a lot of these ideas, biblical scholar Dr. Michael Heiser. So when I look at Chris White's site, the first thing that I see, and I want you to respond to, is this. He says one of the biggest problems with Atwell's theory is the existence of Christianity before 73 AD. So before the sacking of the temple, he's saying that Christianity is shown to have existed in the historical accounts we have, and therefore your contention that these gospels were created after 73 AD is, as he says, the theory is toast. So first of all, the question I want to ask is that accurate? Does your theory hinge on there being no historical evidence for Christianity prior to 73 AD?
Well, no. In fact, there was Christianity prior to 73. It, of course, depends on how you're using the term. I would say that the Messianic movement that rebelled against Rome was a Christian, a kind of Christianity. Christ simply means anointed in Greek, and it's just referring to the relationship between a Jewish leader and God. And so the zealots would certainly have been seen as Christian. In fact, Josephus stated that what most propelled them was their belief in these messianic prophecies. So just from a definitional perspective, there were Christianities, not just one, but other forms of this understanding of the Hebraic prophecies before 73. As far as Roman Christianity and the Gospels, no, there weren't any of those in existence before the Gospels had been written. There are a number of historians that people make references to concerning descriptions of early Christians. I think Chris White refers to Tacitus. Others point out Josephus, who also has a passage called the Testimonium, where the character Jesus Christ is mentioned. Suetonius describes Christians, and I believe Dio. Yeah, Dio, of course, also does too. So this is the group that you have as sort of the historians that are describing Roman Christianity prior to 73, or perhaps say 80, when the Gospels would have been written. But you see, there's one really interesting thing that links all of those historians together. Suetonius, Josephus, Tacitus, and Dio, the people who talk about this character, Jesus Christ, and about Christians. They are all Flavian court historians, every one. And every one of them also took the position that the Jewish messianic prophecies foresaw not a Jew, but the Flavian Caesar. Every one of them recorded that insane and incredible concept. So when you look at the Gospels and you look at my work, you see that they were definitely produced in the Flavian compound. Somehow this group was able to generate this literature. So the literature just is a false history. It's a fiction about a character living in 30 to 33.
But let me just take you back, because I want to reemphasize the first point that you make, or I want to dig into it. I don't want to say emphasize because I don't know, but you're quite well versed in the Dead Sea Scrolls as well.
Yeah.
So there's evidence that we have, historical evidence, archaeological evidence, of this group of very radical Jewish rebels, really, who were fighting against the Roman Empire.
Well, they're messianic, though. That's the important thing, is that their literature shows that they were looking for a Messiah that would lead them. And this of course, is exactly the element that Josephus stated was the thing that most brought about the rebellion. So when the Gospels describe a son of man that's going to come with the conclusion of the Roman War, they are essentially taking the Jewish prophecies and trying to morph it onto the Roman Caesar. And so now when you look at not just Josephus, but there are other court historians, Suetonius, Tacitus, and Dio, and they all say the same thing, you can see a kind of unification of theology that is perverted, because obviously claiming that the Jews' prophecy foresaw Caesar is, you know, not a strong rational position.
Right.
But they all held it, and it was sort of just the official position of the Flavian court. So, you know, getting back to the using these historians who make this claim as then the basis for the historicity of Jesus Christ. Well, wait a second. Let's just back up. The analysis I show showing the connection between the Gospels and Josephus, which incidentally is not, you know, I don't conjecture. I just lay the text out side by side, and I just say, look, here's the relationship. Anyone can see this. This voids the purported objective history of these individuals. They just become part of the plot. So now when you have them claiming the messianic prophecies foresee the Flavian Caesar, they're obviously just repeating the theological position that's found in the Gospels. They're completely aware of the Gospels and the story of Jesus. That's where they get their understanding from. And so then when you read, you know, Tacitus or Suetonius making some little comment about, you know, Christians, you know, what are they doing? They're simply repeating this false history that they're trying to get people to take seriously.
And moreover, I think if we connect those two, they didn't have to completely invent that story. They just had to tweak that story. So there were rebels in the streets that were being prosecuted or persecuted, depending on how you look at it. There was rebellion. There was probably acts that were being taken and brutalization and all that
stuff. Of course.
It's just the tweak of...
You know, that's very well stated, very well said. That's exactly what they did. They knew they couldn't get rid of Judaism. All they wanted to do was just to bend the messianic prophecies from producing rebellion to just being able to get along with the Roman Empire. So they concocted this character, Jesus Christ, who's pro-Roman. He's sort of metrosexual. He's, you know, turning the other cheek. He's kind of pacifistic. He's just sort of tweaking the religion in the direction that they want so that they will not have to face this constant rebellion coming forward from these messianic zealots. And I look at Christianity, if you actually sort of see it in historical context, as just a continuation of what the family of Herod and the Alexander families, who were partially Jewish or completely Jewish and were the Roman tax collectors of the region of Egypt and of Judea, they had these projects that were trying to tone down the messianic religion. The Herods were trying to breed onto the Maccabean line. They would take Maccabean princesses so that they would then present their sons as legitimate Jewish rulers, or Christ, in fact, because this would be the royal lineage, the lineage of the religious leaders that the Christ came from. And then in the Alexander family, the other tax collectors who were famous Jewish intellectuals, they produced Philo. You look at Philo, you see, you know, you have this toned down Hellenized Judaism, a Judaism that can get along inside the Roman Empire. So this didn't work, and you had this rebellion. And so the next step was just to try to focus it a little bit more completely, to try to get a little more control over the religious activity of the Jews with Christianity, where they would then just put this religion out into, not into Judea. I think that would have been, right, you know, silly, but they would have tried to affect the missionary activity of the movement so it couldn't get to the Jews and to the Gentiles who were susceptible to the religion in, you know, throughout the Roman Empire.
And again, the parallels to what we see in modern society and throughout history are all over the place. It's about doing business and doing what we have to continue to do business and to consolidate our power. And why wouldn't we do it? It's just an easy way to further advance our position and to make more money. It's not that complicated.
Still going on today. I mean, this is just how rulers mind control their subjects to maintain power. They want to preserve wealth and power, and they want the subjects to agree to do things and accept things that are not in their interest. So they mind control them with religion. That's all Christianity was.
So, Joe, next in my little journey here, I went to Dr. Richard Carrier's blog, and I began posting there, and I engaged in a pretty interesting dialogue with him. Now, Carrier is an interesting guy. For folks who don't know, Ivy League historian, biblical scholar, who's also an atheist and a mythicist. That is, he maintains that Jesus Christ, as a historical person described in the Bible, never existed. Now, as everybody knows, atheism in academia is not a rarity, but atheism within the academic biblical studies kind of niche certainly is. So we would expect Carrier to be one of your natural allies, but he's not. Can you tell us a little bit about your interaction and exchange of ideas with Dr. Carrier, and then we'll kind of dive into some of the more contentious points?
Sure. Way back when, I don't know, years ago, I noticed I was sent criticism of my work that he was producing, and it was clear he hadn't read the book because he was essentially going off and just making up stuff. And so I contacted him and I just said, you know, I read your criticism and it indicates you haven't read the work, and would you mind reading it before you criticize it? And so he said, no, I'm not going to read it, but what I want you to do is just send me your single best example and I'll see if I like it. And if I do, then maybe we can go forward. And I replied, no, this is a typological system. There isn't any, you know, distinctive value that one parallel has over the other. He said, no, you've got to send me something. And so I sent him not my analysis, because he wouldn't read it, but simply the citations, the passages themselves. And so he read the passages without my analysis, and then came up with his own understanding of the parallelism.
So let me hone in on a couple of the points that I had an exchange with him about. I can't claim to have represented your position very well, because I really am just trying to scramble around and get my feet under me in this area. But I'll tell you a couple of points that I brought up in his response. The first thing that I brought up was that, hey, what we've just been talking about, that it seems obvious that this kind of relationship between rulers and nation states and religion has been going on all the time. So the question is not whether the Romans used Christianity in that way. It's just a question of when. And Carrier's response to that was a little bit curious. He said, hey, look, if you're talking about the 4th century, if you're talking about 302 and Constantine, sure, we all know that, yeah. But that's not Atwell's thesis. Atwell's pushing it back further, and he's not supporting enough evidence for how you can push it back.
No, I just can't even understand the grammar of the criticism. Why would the Flavians have different motivations than Constantine in terms of religion?
Well, I think he pushes back on the idea of the Flavian influence in the early Catholic Church, because my response was to say, look, I don't know why you're hostile to the Flavian influence, even if you just do a Wikipedia, or I think where I found it was in the Catholic Encyclopedia. You know, immediately you start seeing Flavian this, Flavian that, and Flavian, what is it?
Flava Domitilla.
Flava Domitilla.
Yeah.
You know, so, but then he pushes back and says, wait a minute, you know, you guys are being suckers for Christian apologetics. There isn't really that connection between the Flavians and this early Christian period. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, in fact, the traditions that link the Flavians to the early church are in existence. And you can fantasize about how they came about, but you can't simply, unless you're, you know, not in the rational context, you can't claim they don't exist. There's a whole collection of Flavians that are seen as having been members of the early Roman Christian church. When you look at the origins of Christianity and the different theories, you don't have enough, you know, data points to really know just from the history, from the historical data as to what actually occurred. But what you really want to do is try to have theories that fit into the data that we have. And obviously the Flavian Christians, the Roman Catholic Church refers to them as the Christian Flavi. There's so many, they've actually coined a term, would be what you would expect that would have emerged from a Flavian origin of the religion.
And we keep saying Flavian here. I mean, Really, you're just talking about a family, a clan, if you will. And they bring in other people like Josephus, and they're adopted in. But they're the bushes back in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a family that seized power. It's the family that waged war against the Messianic movement in the first century. And it's the family that fulfilled all of the prophecies, so-called, that Jesus Christ makes. Now, the victors tend to write history. And so when you look at Jesus describing military victories of the Flavians throughout his prophecies, the first thing that you should ask yourself is, well, who produced this literature? Who would really want to have their victories commemorated like this? And obviously the Flavians would be a candidate for it.
But I think one of the stumbling blocks for folks in general, and I don't want to speak for Carrier, but my reading between the lines of what he's saying is, okay, you're at, let's say, 70, 80 AD. Now you're at 302 AD. You're talking about, you know, 220 years. Is there really this continuation of this clan, of this dynasty, of this group of influence called the Flavians? Is it unbroken in the way that you're talking about? That doesn't seem as impossible to me as it maybe is to other people. But
I think the logic is screwy. Look, I don't have to show more history than there are data to be able to, you know, reveal. The fact is that the relationship between the Gospels and the history that the Flavian family produced is self-evident. It's a different quality of evidence. Right. I'm not asking people to accept fantasies about who were Flavius Constantine ancestors or what happened to the Roman Catholic Church between the year 200 and 304. No one knows these things. There isn't enough data to definitively state one way or another about these things. We just don't have the information. But we do have our two books. And when you take these books and put them side by side, you can see that one is dependent upon the other. From there, you can concoct all sorts of historical plausibilities. But the fact is that they show that the works of the Flavian family were unified, that the Gospels and the history of Josephus are dependent literature. And so, you know,
just to recap that, to put an explanation point on that point, because it's really a good one. You're saying Josephus, who becomes a Flavian under unusual but extremely relevant and interesting circumstances. He's a guy who they're fighting against. They conquer him. They flip him and say, come on over to our side. You'll be useful. You know the language. You know the culture. You can help us dominate these people. And they like him so much, they adopt him into their family. And then they say, okay, go write that history now. Go tell folks what really happened. And he writes that history. And as you say, if you put that history down side by side with the Gospels, the parallels are just inescapable. I mean, there's no way to get around them.
And not that I'm in general presenting parallels that have never been seen before. Many of these parallels have actually been widely discussed. What they haven't done is they simply haven't seen that they were occurring in the same sequence. So in other words, everyone knows that Jesus's prophecy about the encircling of Jerusalem is based on an event in history. And they know that Josephus recorded that event, and he's the only one who did. You know, they also know that temple was razed. And again, they know when Jesus makes the prophecy in the Gospels. But what they don't do is they don't set up simply the structure of one parallel next to the other in sequence. Because, you see, sequence is a very powerful thing. It doesn't occur accidentally.
Joe, why don't we follow that up then and tell folks a little bit about the book and also, if you will, about the excellent movie that you produced. Very, very high quality, very well done film, no matter how someone might view the thesis or the ideas behind it. It really communicates effectively.
Thank you. I'll just say you can buy the book, go to caesarsmessiah.com, and it's available there. The book is without any sort of a promotion budget. I'm often amazed at people who think that there's some kind of advertising of Caesar's Messiah that goes on. I haven't spent a single dollar promoting the book, and I bought the rights back from my publisher back in like 2008. I haven't spent a penny. I was approached by someone who'd read the book to make a documentary, Fritz Heed. And I agreed to do so because I really enjoyed the documentaries that he had worked on before, Secret of the Sphinx and The Secret War of Desert Storm. I just happened to think those were two of the best documentaries I'd ever seen. And because he had a really deep understanding of the literature, and I mean, he really had read it closely, I thought it would be a worthwhile project. The recent event in London that got so much publicity, the Covert Messiah lectures that I gave in England, again, I had nothing to do with this. I was approached by someone who had read the book, had a very deep understanding of it, and wanted to bring out a lecture series to in Britain. And I agreed to go over, and I did essentially a seminar in London and then another series in Brighton. These were just, you know, I thought it would be interesting, and I thought the individuals who were wanting to do the venues were very credible, and they had a deep understanding. And so I said, sure, I'll be happy to do it.
And if your tone sounds a little bit defensive, people need to know that that's been kind of spun, that whole thing, both the video and the lecture series, as you being some kind of spin doctor that was trying to resurrect some theory that had been long discounted and disproven, and you were just trying to...
You know, the people who are making that claim were the spin doctors. You know, obviously the Christians were up in arms because, you know, I was going to discuss the Flavian confession of having created the character Jesus Christ. And I did. I actually showed the literature that is an actual confession of the invention of the religion. So they were upset about that and protested. And then, oddly, the New Testament scholars weighed in. Carrier wrote a piece. A couple other guys made negative comments. But no one had read the book.
Well, Joe, it's been great having you on. Thanks again so much for joining me.